Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. If we just let it be, na 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 na, the world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.
That's right. The world will not get any better if we just let it be. We got to change this world, you and me. We'd like to welcome you on the 12th of June, 2021, to Missing Pages of History, MPH Radio. Our theme tonight is Tulsa 2021, then and there. That's right, Tulsa 1921, that's correction, then and now. We're going to talk about this important event, and we're going to talk about it from a different perspective. We're going to get this history from the people. We're going to let the people tell their own history, and we have a very interesting young lady, Sister Camille, who will bring you a different perspective on this thing, and this is going to be the major feature of today's program. But before we get to that section, like always on MPH Radio, we want to give you something to think about. Followed by some MPH Black Mini Facts and a message from the community from Alex Joyner. That's going to be the order of the day. And from this point on, what we're going to do right now is ask you to take out your pen and pencil, and we're going to give you something to think about. Later on during the program, you can respond back on this particular or these particular concepts as it deals with freedom. We're going to give you something to think about. What is freedom? We're taking three definitions or three concepts of freedom from Brother Jameel, from Brother Malcolm X, and he stated three concepts when it comes to this concept of freedom. And those concepts were: one, he stated that you don't have to be a man to fight for freedom. All you have to be is to be an intelligent human being. What do you think about that concept of freedom? You don't have to be a man to fight for freedom. All you have to do is to be an intelligent human being. The second concept of freedom was you get your freedom by letting your enemy know that you will do anything to get it. Then you'll get it. It's the only way you'll get it. Let me read that one again. You get your freedom by letting your enemy know that you'll do anything to get it. Then you'll get it. It's the only way you'll get it. And the third concept of freedom is the only way we'll get freedom for ourselves, identify ourselves with every oppressed people in the world. We are blood brothers to the people of Brazil, Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba. Yes, Cuba too. So those are Brother Malcolm three concepts of freedom. What you think about these concepts? How do you apply them in your daily lives? Because remember, freedom is a concept that is often discussed and talked about, and hundreds of millions of people have died over this concept. So if we want to be free, I think it would be best to behoove us to know what we mean by this concept of freedom. So those are the three concepts of freedom that we are giving you something to think about. Right now, we're going to go to Sister Susie. She can share with us with some MPH Black Mini Facts. Right now, we bring Susie. We'd like to welcome her to MPH Radio. And Susie, what do you have for us for this week as relates to MPH Black Mini Facts? Welcome to MPH Radio, Susie.
Good evening. Today's mini facts is coming from the PRSP 2021 calendar, and it starts with June the 6th, where the civil rights activist Jay Meredith was shot during Voter Rights March in 1966. Now, for June the 7th, Gwendolyn Brooks, which was a poet born in Topeka, Kansas, in 1917. June the 8th, Leroy Satchel Paige, great African baseball pitcher, died in 1982. On the 10th, Marcus Garvey, Pan-African organizer of the UNIA, died in England in 1940. Nigeria unions representing millions of workers launched a general strike over fuel price hikes in 2004. On June 11th, the revolutionary Angola placed 13 British and U.S. imperialist mercenaries on trial in 1976. And the last day of June the 12th, the Convention's People's Party, the CPP, led by Kwame Nkrumah, was founded in 1949. I've just given you many facts for the week of June the 6th through the 12th. And I'd like to thank you, and this information came from the PRSP 2021 calendar.
We'd like to thank Susie for her little Black Mini Facts or MPH, and we'd like to just add one little quick one to that. Also on this day of the 12th in 1963, Medgar Evers, he was an African civil rights activist, was also assassinated. So let's move forward. We're going to pause for the calls right now. I'm going to leave you with a music with a message, and when we come back, we're going to have a message from the community with Brother Alex. You are listening to MPH Radio.
Children's laughter. Everybody's searching for a hero. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone who fulfilled my needs. A lonely place to be. And so I learned.
That's right, learning to love yourself, love your people, and love humanity is the greatest love of them all. Welcome back to MPH Radio. You're listening to the voice of MPH. Right now, we'll move forward to our next segment, dealing with a message to the community. We will bring in Brother Alex, and the views that you hear is totally the expression of Brother Alex Joyner, not necessarily the views of the organization or this radio station. Right now, Brother Alex, we'd like to welcome you to MPH Radio. And what is your message today to our community?
I would like to welcome the callers and the listeners today to a very positive and inspiring show. I thank the guest speaker and the other commentators for their facts and information they will present. Finally, I thank the staff, Missing Pages, Susie, what a wonderful introduction is always a fact, and Mr. Robinson for that knowledge that we so desperately need. In your untiring efforts, you bring us that knowledge and uncovered history that most of us have not learned public educational system. But I have, over the past year, given a lot of thank you out to the ones who have provided me a service. Regardless of how small it may have been, it is worth telling someone they did well and you appreciated it. Sometimes we're all guilty of not letting another know their best effort made a difference. We often expect that because we paid or is paying for something, we should receive the best service anyway. Today, I would like to thank the countless ones who have been out there serving our nation throughout the pandemic the past year. I give them a personal uplift as they and I will continue to wear a mask until the safety of others is achieved through mass vaccination and social responsibility. Seen and been through harsher events in history, we have had strong and determined leadership that asked all Americans to do their fair share. I thank the millions who gave their lives so we might share the treasured freedom that they could only wish for or dream about. We together will come from the valley to the mountaintop of freedom, justice, and liberty for all. This hopeful vision and opportunity cannot be lost. Hatred, bigotry, and racism will always be a resistance and a foe to the disadvantaged. Our struggle is not over. It is only expanding to the developing minds of our youth. It is now their struggle as well. So for our representative today, and our guest host, I give this to you. But this is a fellow Oklahoma I would like to talk about. Who was that masked man? A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a heart to it. Hi, yo, Silver, the Lone Ranger. In the early days of the Western United States, the masked man and his faithful Indian companion rode the plains, searching for truth and justice. They were daring and resourceful as they led the fight for law and order. Nowhere can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us to those thrilling days of yesterday. The Lone Ranger rides again. I believe that to have a friend, a man must be one, that all men are created equal, and that everyone has within himself the power to make this a better world, that God put the firewood there, but that every man must gather and light it himself in being prepared physically, mentally, and morally to fight when necessity for what is right. That a man must make the most of the equipment he has, that his government, of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall live always. That men should live by the rule of what is best for the greatest number. That sooner or later, somewhere, somehow, we must settle with the world and make payment for what we have taken. That all things change but the truth, and that the truth alone lives on forever. In my Creator, my country, my fellow man. The moral code of the Lone Ranger, as depicted by Fran Stryker in his conception of the Lone Ranger radio and TV series in 1933 to present. As a child, I did not know that this hit TV series was created because of Bass Reeves, an outstanding African-American United States Marshal. Mr. Reeves was loved by so many that the tales of his good deeds and honest assessments of the criminals he brought to justice was astounding. The code and creed he followed to bring in a fugitive on a warrant of arrest is often ignored by today's law enforcement. He wore a mask as a disguise to hide his appearance and not to strike fear in the innocent he protected. To me, wearing a mask at an early age was cool. So now as I see people wearing a mask, I respect that they are not trying to rob me or take away my rights. They are there to help me, as mask wearers always have. The doctor, surgeons, dentists, and nurses who are masked are trying to prevent spreading infections and disease, and they should be thanked for their sacrifices to serve regardless of the patients before them. The firefighter, as well as the waiter servant, is looking out for our safety. The airline steward, as well as the city bus driver, is confirmed for our health. The auto mechanic, as well as the store clerk, is masked up to stop the spread of germs also. A whole lot of people have been doing the job of decent, honest people who care for someone else they did not know. I appreciate what you have done to make the rest of us safe. Over 600,000 American citizens have died because we had a past leadership that ignored the simplicity that wearing a mask meant that you cared for your fellow Americans regardless of color or wealth. Why do so many attack and resent these heroes so foolishly? To wear a mask until the end of the year, regardless of what the government says, as a tribute to the lives lost, and to remember that doing the right thing is never wrong. I remember that once, as a country, that the sight of a black man on a white horse who gave out silver dollars as gifts meant a community was safe from other criminals at large who were the bad guys. After everyone else to stop wearing masks in a few months, I will continue to do so again. So I expect to hear, who is that masked man? I will smile to myself, thank God that it allowed me to live, and remind others that the mask we wore saved others, as my childhood hero did, with his respect and love for others that he did not know. Yes, we are only better if we choose to be respected ones who wear the mask to save a life. And again, I thank you.
Thank you, Brother Alex, for your message to the community. And now what we will do, we're going to take a quick break with music with a message. And when we come back, we're going to have Sister Camille. And she's dealing with our major focus today. That is the history of Tulsa, 1921, then and now. Don't you go nowhere, because this sister has a not only an interesting story, but she has a very unique way of sharing the true history of our people. So when we come back, we're going to talk about Tulsa, 1921, then and now with our sister Camille. We'll be right back. This is MPH Radio. That's right, we are here. We are here for all of us. But right now, we're going to talk about a very important historical event that many people have never heard of or know about. And in essence, it's one of our missions to fill in those many missing pages of history. And the history we're going to talk about today, our major feature, is on Tulsa, 1921, then and now. And to share that particular history with us, we have with us Sister Camille, who lives in the area, in the state of Oklahoma. And she is an educator, a historian, a writer, a book owner. She's a lady of many skills and many disciplines. And she can share a story of Tulsa, 1921, that you have rarely ever heard of. So right now, what we want to do is the honors and privilege. We'd like to bring Sister Camille in, and we would like to welcome her to MPH Radio. Sister Camille, are you there? Welcome to MPH Radio. Can you
I'm
hear
sorry.
Me, Sister Camille?
I was muted. I'm sorry. Thank you,
yeah,
Brother Lee. And can you hold on just 1 second? I apologize for this.
Okay. While she's waiting to get us out together, listen to her. Get your pen and paper out. Because she can share with you some stuff that you never knew, never heard, and always of interest. So, Sister Camille, you know, all around the world now, they're actually talking about the incident of Tulsa during 1921. And everybody had their own perspective and their own slant and their own story on this particular phenomenon. We'd like to hear yours. So when we can just open up the mic right now to us and you tell us about the history of Tulsa 1921, then and now. So the mic is yours.
Thank you very much, Brother Lee, and greetings and welcome and gratitude to all those who are listening in to learn this important history, but most importantly, to say never again. Say it with me, my people, never again.
Never again.
Thank you. So let me set the scene for Tulsa in 1921, because understanding the background helps you understand what happened. Now, each and every living one of us, descendants of Africa, children of Africa, has experienced racism in some shape, form, or fashion repeatedly from the womb to the tomb. We are accustomed to dealing with this. But understanding what was going on in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just after the turn of the century, just after the close of the First Great War, is essential to understanding how the Tulsa Massacre occurred. First of all, it was a time when African people, having been so-called emancipated from our chains, were seeking self-determination. The state of Oklahoma had 53 black townships and many more communities like Greenwood that were part of larger or part of municipalities that were incorporated as, you know, not as black towns. So these are Africans who had been released from chattel slavery and had walked, had ridden in wagons, had ridden on the backs of mules, had jumped freight trains and ridden to Oklahoma Territory to find communities and to build communities of our own where the foot of white supremacy would not be choking the life out of our necks every minute of every day of our lives. We built homes. We plowed fields. We brought forth crops from the fields. We bought cotton gins and took our crops to the market, our cotton to the market, and kept the profits for the first time in hundreds of years of picking cotton. We established banks and schools and churches and libraries. We established grocery stores and pharmacies. We had doctors. We had lawyers. We had healer women. We had midwives. We had artists. We had poets. We had musicians. We had communities of African people who were enjoying our first taste of relative freedom in many a generation. And oh, how we thrived and how we reveled in the ability to live our lives as full and complete human beings without the day-to-day threat of white supremacy wiping out our lives and diminishing our personhood. So, meanwhile, in the state of Oklahoma and surrounding areas, black gold was discovered. Oil was being pulled from the ground, and it was a boom. You've heard talk of the gold rush. Well, this was the oil rush, and people came from all over the world to claim that land and to enrich themselves by pulling that oil out of the ground and enjoying the riches that it conferred. Well, it just so happened that a whole lot of that land where the black gold was laying in hiding was owned by black people who had come to settle in this land of Oklahoma. A lot of it was owned by native people, and that didn't sit so well. So you had African people in Tulsa and other parts of Oklahoma all of a sudden found themselves among the wealthiest people in the country. certainly the wealthiest African people in the country, but wealthier than most white folks. And you also had a boom town. Tulsa's nickname was Magic City, and it's because the magic was happening there. People were becoming rich beyond their wildest dreams, and even people who weren't getting rich were working steadily. And this was in a time where there had been a real economic depression before World War I, and after World War I, when the soldiers returned home and started looking for jobs, and there weren't any jobs to be had. So it was a time of economic strife, economic stress. It was also a time of overwhelming white nationalism, white supremacy, not just in Oklahoma, not just in Tulsa, but all over the country. So lynching, white violence, has always been the response to black womanhood and black manhood. When we stand up for ourselves, we put our lives at risk. That was the case then. It remains the case to this very day. Oklahoma happened to be the state in the Union that had the greatest percentage of native-born Americans. In other words, the lowest percentage of immigrants. Immigration was a big thing in America in the 1920s and the 19-teens and 20s, and there was heavy, heavy anti-immigrant sentiment. So not only did these folks hate African people, they hated Jews, they hated Catholics, they hated Italians, they hated Poles, they hated Irishmen, they hated every doggone body. Hatred was the name of the game. It was a competition for who was going to live a good life and who was going to be left to collect the dregs, to eat the crumbs. Well, into that situation came African men, black men who had been drafted to fight into World War I and who came home having experienced the relative freedom that they found in Europe, where they could walk into any cafe and get served a drink or a meal. And people would not only not turn their noses up at them or shoo them off, they would applaud them for coming there and fighting in that war of liberation that saved them and their country. They got put on the troop ships and sent on back. But when they got back to their homes, whether they were in Tulsa or whether they were in Mobile, or whether they were in Indianola, Mississippi, or wherever they found themselves, they were not in the mood to take any more of the BS that suggested, that told them that they were not full, complete, and free human beings. Lynching was a real issue in America in the 19-teens and 20s. Hundreds and hundreds of African people were hung from trees, their bodies charred. You've heard the song, Strange Fruit. Many more were beaten to death, and some of them were just disappeared. My great-granddaddy told me that you weren't even allowed to laugh in the presence of a white man unless he had told you a joke, and even then it might not be safe. You couldn't show anything that would be considered to be disrespectful, because your life was on the line. People were lynched. People were murdered for the crime of establishing successful businesses and walking away from their sharecrop land to make their own way and enjoy the fruits of their own labor. Being black was then and is now a crime in this country and in the motherland. Understand also that we're talking about a time when King Leopold of Belgium murdered hundreds of thousands, millions of our brothers and sisters in the Congo and surrounding land. So this wasn't just a local problem. This was and still is a global issue. And I ask you, when you think about this, when you contemplate it, consider it in that global arena, to consider that what happens to us also happens to our sisters and brothers elsewhere, and it's part and parcel of the same problem. So let me go back to Tulsa. This is what happened on Memorial Day weekend of 1921 in Tulsa. There was a young brother, 17 years old. He called himself Diamond Dick. He was a shoeshine. The word was boy. He had left high school where he was a football and track star and was shining shoes in downtown Tulsa. Because there was so much money in it, he was able to support himself and his extended family with the money he made shining white people's and black people's boots. On the day of May 31st, 1921, Diamond Dick Rowland, as he was called, went to the Drexel Building in downtown Tulsa. It was the only building in town that had a toilet that black people were allowed to use in the downtown area, and an elevator that black people were allowed to ride to the top of the 7- or 8-story building that housed the one toilet that we had access to. You know, because there's all kinds of ways to strip a person of his manhood or her womanhood. And that was just one of them. So Dick Rowland entered an elevator that was operated by a 17-year-old white girl from Missouri by the name of Sarah Page. Now, people in the community say that Dick and Sarah were lovers. They certainly knew each other. They certainly had been seen together. Black people say that Dick and Sarah had planned to run away to Mexico or Canada to someplace where they could be married because anti-miscegenation laws were on the books in virtually all states in America, and even if it wasn't against the law, it could easily get you killed. Whether that's the case or not, Sarah Rowland, somebody saw Dick and Sarah on the elevator together, and Sarah, when she was asked what happened, said that he had stumbled into her. Sarah Page never said that she was assaulted, but the Tulsa newspaper ran a story saying that a white woman had been assaulted and defiled, that was the word that they used, by a young Negro. He went into hiding. Dick Rowland went into hiding, but he was found and he was arrested. The black men of Tulsa's Greenwood District, a thriving district that had hundreds of businesses, had 7 banks, had a library, had several schools, had many churches, had shops and businesses and manufactories and all sorts of other things. It was called the Greenwood District, but Booker T. Washington had called it Black Wall Street, thriving community. The men of Greenwood who had appeared and who had armed themselves and gone to other places to stop lynchings knew that this was one of those situations. And so they gathered with their weapons in front of the courthouse. Mob gathered as well and demanded that Dick Rowland be released. They intended to lynch him. Now, let me say that lynching was popular not only of African people, but of white people as well, and certainly of indigenous people. A scant year before the Tulsa incident, a white man had murdered a white taxi driver, and a white mob took him out of the Tulsa County Jail and lynched him in a nearby park. So black folks are thinking, well, if they'll do this to a white man, we know what's going to happen to our young brother. And they stood in front of the courthouse in front of the mob. Well, the sheriff called up his deputies, and they managed to spirit Dick Rowland out of the courthouse before the lynch mob could get a hold of him. He went into hiding and was not seen again. People in the Greenwood community say that Dick Rowland left town in a big hurry and changed his name and went to live elsewhere. Sarah Page also disappeared. We know not to this day whether they were together at that time or ever. But that's really kind of neither here nor there, because what we've got is a bloodthirsty white mob standing on the courthouse steps, angry at the fact that they had been robbed of their chance to hang a black man from a tree, angry at the fact that they were amidst black affluence. By the way, the distance between the courthouse and the Greenwood community was only a few short blocks in downtown Tulsa. So we're talking about something that happened geographically very close to each other, these incidents. So the mob gathers, and as the sun goes down, the later it gets, the angrier the mob gets. They start snatching black men. The black men who had come there to guard the place hurried home to surround their community in defensive positions and to move as many people as they could into a church, Vernon Church, Zion Church, where they felt they would be safe, be able to claim the ancient right of sanctuary because they were on hallowed ground. So the white mob got angrier and angrier, and they start snatching up random black people, and pretty soon the mob has gathered. The mayor of Tulsa called for help from the governor, and the governor turned out the National Guard. The National Guard, many of whom had been present for a Memorial Day parade earlier that day, mustered out. But instead of defending the black community of Greenwood, Oklahoma, they joined into the burning, the looting. I've heard stories, and I'm going to share some more of them with you in a minute. But by the time midnight rolled around on the 31st of May, the 1st of June, much of the Greenwood district lay in rubble or was still burning. Black people were holed up in the churches seeking sanctuary, and that did not stop the mob from burning several churches and people having to run for their lives against the flames. It didn't stop them from breaking out the windows in the churches. It did not stop them from rounding up every black person that they saw while the police, for the most part, stood by. One of the things that it's important to understand is that what was going on in Tulsa in Greenwood prior to the destruction of the Greenwood community was not only the black affluence, but the black independence. Conversely, across the river from Greenwood, within sight of Greenwood, was a white shanty town. Dirt floors, tin roofs, no running water, no indoor plumbing, of white laborers who had come to Magic City to make their own way in the world. And when they looked at Greenwood with affluent, confident, proud African people, there was rage. So these were the folks that went. And first they looted. Now, one of the things you have to ask yourself was, why were these black people doing so good? Why were their houses filled with fine furniture? Why were they wearing beautiful clothes? And the answer to that in part was, we had to establish our own stores. We had to establish our own businesses where seamstresses and tailors made good-looking clothes for us, because, you know, Africans always like to be clean and pretty. We could not go downtown to buy a suit of clothes. Well, you could buy one, but you couldn't try it on first. And if you got it home and it didn't fit, you were stuck with it. You had to pass it on to somebody else because you couldn't return it to the store after your black hands had defiled it. So we built our own. So the white mob is going from house to house, looting what they could and destroying the rest. They broke out the windows. They threw gasoline on the houses and lit them in flames. Somebody got into an airplane with Molotov cocktails and sticks of dynamite. The gasoline, of course, readily available, and the dynamite used in the drilling of oil wells. Tulsa, Oklahoma, was the first U.S. city to be bombed from the air. And I will ask you to contemplate what the second and only other American city to be bombed from the air might be. I'm sure you know the answer to that question, but I'll tell you later. So the black people that survived the looting, the burning, the shooting, were herded into the nearby county fairgrounds and put up in animal stalls where they were kept for weeks and weeks thereafter in these animal cages in the fairgrounds, guarded by the state militia, the National Guard, and by Tulsa police and white mobs who had just self-deputized to hold each other, to hold these black folks into these cages while they continued the destruction of Wall Street. By the time the sun came up, the Tulsa Tribune newspaper estimated that as many as 350 people had died. About 100 of those were supposed to be white people and the rest Africans. The African community tells that story differently, saying that a relatively few number of white people died and well over 350 African people were murdered. The total number is not known. One story I heard about that fateful night came from a man who had learned this story from the lips of his grandparents and his great-grandparents who had come to Oklahoma City, who had fled Tulsa from Oklahoma City. He said his father had been rounded up and his mother did not know whether his daddy was alive or dead. She had a newborn baby. She was at home in her nightdress at the time when the mob came banging on her door and kicked it in. They said, "Woman, you got 30 seconds to get out of this house." And she says, "I'm in my nightdress. I've got a baby." And they said, "You got 20 seconds. She says, "Where am I going to go in my nightdress and with my newborn infant, a less than two-week-old infant?" The mob leader said, "You got 10 seconds now." She snatched a tablecloth off of her dining room table and wrapped it around herself and her baby and ran barefooted toward the railroad tracks in an area where she had other family members. It was a pitch black night. Not only were there no streetlights to speak of outside of the main part of town at that time in 1921, it was an overcast, cloudy night. It had rained hard the day before and was cloudy, so it was pitch black. Black folks found their way to the railroad tracks, and which was the only way they could determine which direction they were going in, and traveled on foot. He said his grandmama told the story of stumbling along until some man looked at her and said, "Honey, let me give you my shoes. It's better that you have them than I do." And she stepped into these big old shoes. She said they must have been size 15. But she was a little bitty thing, and the shoes clopped on her feet. But at least she wasn't getting splinters in her foot from the railroad ties. And she said to the day that she closed her eyes for the last time, she could remember the sound of her feet hitting those railroad ties, clop, clop, and the weeping of people, quiet weeping, because you did not wish to call any attention to yourself, lest the mob catch a hold of you and do God only knows what to you. That group of people walked to the nearby town of Okmulgee, about 35 miles away, and then scattered to the four winds. This woman's particular family was later reunited. Her husband had not been killed. He was being pinned up at the county fairgrounds, and they made their way to Oklahoma to reestablish their life and to grow their family. There are hundreds and hundreds of such stories. There is a story that one person told of how there was a jitney service, a black-owned jitney service. Jitneys, if you didn't know, are a kind of a cab that operates as a bus along a certain route, and you could hail the jitney and squeeze into that automobile until it was full, and people and the jitney would drive you up and down the boulevard or to your door for a little bit extra money. And the jitneys were still running until fairly late at night, and they were gathering up primarily women and children, 12, 15 people stuffed into the back of an old Packard, or including in the trunk, trying to escape the mob violence. There was a white bus driver who took mercy upon the people of Greenwood and said, "Get on the bus and I will take you to safety." And he told them to get on the bus and to lie down so that their black faces could not be seen through the window. And he rolled the sign to say, "Going back to the barn." You know how a bus does when it's off the route. And the white folks didn't pay any attention to him. And he carried dozens of African people to safety just on the outskirts of Tulsa, where they hid in a park until daybreak and then scattered into neighboring communities. There were stories of white families who gathered up the black people who had worked for them, because there was still an awful lot of us in service to white people, house cleaners, janitors, chauffeurs, and that kind of thing, and hid them in their homes, in their garages, in their attics, in the same way that Anne Frank hid from the Nazis for days until they were able to sneak them out of town, because white people who were caught trying to help black people were subject to getting beat. Tulsa was one of the headquarters of the KKK at the time, by the way, and many streets in downtown cities, downtown portions of Oklahoma towns, including Oklahoma City where I live, are named after people who were officers of the KKK. Thousands of African people ran for their lives that night. Hundreds and hundreds more, really well over 2,000, were holed up at the county fairgrounds. After, when daybreak came, and days later when the smoldering ruins stopped smoking, these people were pressed into service by the Tulsa police, by the National Guard, to clear the rubble of their own homes, their own communities, and told to pitch tents on top of the rubble. Some people remained in those tents for more than a year and a half through one of the most bitter winters that Oklahoma had experienced to date, where there was snow and freezing temperatures more days than not. People think of Oklahoma as being southern, but let me say, although we have temperatures that are routinely in the hundreds in the summertime, it is routinely well below freezing in the wintertime, and we get plenty of ice and snow as well. So the pain and the degradation and the depredation continued for months afterwards. People held in bondage, in slavery, and forced to clear the rubble. People living in tents. People holed up in the animal stalls of the county fairgrounds, and people scattered to the four winds. And the refusal of the city of Tulsa to allow people to sell building materials, to allow people to rebuild their homes, the refusal of the city and the county of Tulsa to issue building permits to allow people to rebuild. The water was cut off to the Greenwood community. The electrical lines were not restored. So this was not just mob violence. This was violence inflicted by the state of Oklahoma and the U.S. government, which stood by and took no action on the people of the Greenwood District of Tulsa. And that damage continues to this very day. What does it mean to lose generational wealth when you have literally walked out of slavery, out of Jim Crow, out of oppression to a place where you could build a life and you establish a business and you build a home? You intend to be able to pass it down to your babies when you close your eyes. What does it mean when that generational wealth is stolen from you and is cut off? It means your children have to pay to bury you. It means that no money comes to your children. They probably have to pay off your bills. It means the next generation is saddled with debt, and the generation after that, and the generation after that. By the time 5 years had gone by, African people do not take no for an answer and do not take defeat lightly. Greenwood had begun to rebuild itself. It never reached quite its previous splendor, but there were once again schools and churches and banks and dress shops and tailor shops and filling stations and automobile repair shops and places that were making buggies and wheels and all the things that needed to be made and sold. There were grocery stores, there were doctors and attorneys and all the other things that had been there before. We rebuilt. But there was a current of fear that existed, because all you had to do was think back to the night of May 31, 1921, to know that if you got too successful, if you got too bold, if you were just too black and proud, your life could be snuffed out in a moment, in a whisper, with a bang. Didn't matter. Your worth only existed so far as you had worth to the economic and financial interests of white people, and as long as you did not violate their sense of supremacy. That continues today. The Greenwood District was thriving in the 1950s, and in the early 1960s, the state of Oklahoma decided to run a highway right smack dab through the middle of it, destroying much of the black wealth. Oh, they got pennies on the dollar for their property, but the community was never the same. Today, if you visit Greenwood, you see beautiful homes. You see some of the historic churches and some new churches. But you also see a large campus of Oklahoma State University planted on land that once held proud African people. You see other city buildings that have encroached upon the Greenwood community. And you see acres upon acres of vacant land, which had once been our pride and joy, that never did come back from the night, the 31st of May, 1921. And so that's my story. If we've got a little bit more time, I can tell about some of the personal stories that have been told to me and that have been recorded in books. But I'd like to open the floor if anybody's got any questions. Yes, certainly.
What we'll do, we take a few questions, then we'll come back to you where you can tell some of these stories, because we believe this is very important. First, I'll start with Alex. Any question or comment you have for Camille, please? Brother Alex.
Yes. I would thank you, Camille, for coming in today and enlightening us with all this information, because this information could never stir my passion any better than knowing the true history, not reading it in a book or listening to it on a tape somewhere or from someone many hands away that has changed history, as many of the tellings that I've learned in the public school system or library system, and even today as we look at the information being changed hands over. And so I would like to just comment and, again, thank you for just a wonderful presentation. But knowing that out of 1919, which was called Red Summer, when there was horrendous lynchings all over America, and all the other massacres that had happened, the Atlanta in 1906, that so many of the European-American descent were not held accountable for their actions. And I think when it got to 1920 and 1921, they got more emboldened and more arrogant in their actions. And yes, the city, as we know, perhaps conspired. We know now that perhaps the National Guard also conspired. So there were more than just one faction working on Greenwood that particular Memorial Day weekend. But it was just that boiled over anger, as you stated, that African Americans had finally got somewhere, had finally did something. We're now learning to read, to write, to educate, to bank, to trade among themselves, and have faith among each other. And that was unacceptable, because we needed to go to another set of society to get what we needed. Because one day, maybe some of those electrical companies or some of those water companies or some of those telephone companies, car companies, more of those banks would be in minority hands. And so now you're looking at going a different way. And I think that was a huge problem. And if you can just comment in your stories later to what the people said. And hopefully that my ideas about this is right, that was the change. That was the anger. That's what was taking place in Tulsa at that time, that we had gone too far. We climbed the mountain too high. And we needed to know our place. And I thank you.
Okay, let's take another comment, maybe from Susie, or a question, Susie. Any comment, question you'd like to have for our guest today, Camille, as the Lacey Tulsa 1921?
Yes, Ms. Camille, I was just wondering, have you ever spoken or familiar with Viola Fletcher, who went before Congress to testify on behalf of Tulsa? Have you ever spoken to her personally?
I have met her, but I can't claim to know her.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering because she testified, and being at 107 years old, she was able to remember a lot of things that happened, which correspond with what you've also been telling us today. I just want to thank you for the information.
You're very welcome. One thing that I want to say is when I want to talk a little bit about the fact that most people are hearing about the Tulsa Massacre for the first time now. My younger daughter was in a university history class some years ago here in Oklahoma, and the professor told the story of the Greenwood Massacre, and a young white girl stood up and she said, "I've been in Tulsa all my life, born and bred here. My grandparents came here. My great-grandparents made the land run. I'm an Oklahoman. I know Oklahoma history, and I've never heard tell anything about like that. This is a damn lie." And she stomped out of the classroom. And the professor, who was a white guy, said, "This is the problem. White people are allowed to inflict destruction upon black people with impunity, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about dropping a bomb in 1921 or putting your knee on a neck in 2020. It has not changed. People, white people are allowed to inflict white violence upon black bodies with impunity, and that's got to stop." I'm going to tell you a couple of these stories that I'm finding. By the way, this book, and I'm getting this out of a book by a sister named Eddie Faye Gates. It's called Riot on Greenwood, The Total Destruction of Black Wall Street, and it is available where books are sold, and shameless plug, my bookstore, Nappy Roots Books, which you can find at nappyrootsbooks.com. Bookstore in Oklahoma City proudly carries Sister Eddie Faye Gates' wonderful work of scholarship. This is the story of Dorothy Wilson Strickland, who was born November 6, 1912. She said, "My parents moved from Gainesville, Texas to Tulsa. And at the time of the massacre, they lived on Latimer Court, right smack dab in the middle of Greenwood. Her daddy had built a store on Elgin Street in Greenwood. We were asleep," she says, "when the riot broke out the night of May 31st. Dad's store must have been one of the first buildings set afire by the mob. I remember that officials came and got Daddy and took him down to where the store was. When he came back, I said, 'Mama, what did they do to Daddy?' Because when he had left, he was standing tall and upright, but when he came back, he was stooped over and pitiful looking. I guess authorities thought they had control of the Greenwood District the night of May 31st, so when Daddy came back from his burnt-out store, we all went to bed, but authorities did not have control. Fighting, looting, burning, and commotions went on all night. Finally, Daddy decided we'd better get out. So we got us dressed, and we got into Daddy's grocery store, and we fled to the Mohawk Park area, where some other black people were hiding in the bushes and undergrowth and ditches around the park. We left in such a hurry, I hadn't had time to dress properly, which happened to a lot of other fleeing black people who were also improperly dressed. It had been warm inside the house that night, so I was sleeping in my panties. But as we were getting ready to go, Mama rushed me and said, 'It might be cool, get your coat.' So I grabbed my little red winter coat. That's all I had to wear during the rest of our time as riot refugees, my panties and that little red winter coat. I don't remember why, but the coat didn't have any buttons, so you could see all my body except for the little panties. And would you believe it? I even lost the little panties. It happened like this. While we slept on the ground at Mohawk Park, mothers tried to keep their young children warm with their own bodies. Well, during the night, I had to relieve myself. A kind woman knew mother was trying to keep her youngest child warm, so she told mother not to move and that she would take me to a bush where I could do my business. And she did, but she told me to take my panties off and she'd hold them for me. She didn't want me to soil them. And wouldn't you know that at that exact time the mobsters found our hiding place? That good, kind lady pulled me up so fast and got me back to the group that was fleeing that my panties got left behind. I tried to keep that little red coat together to hide my nakedness, but it gaped open and I was exposed. I was so embarrassed, so ashamed. So to this day, when I think about that riot, I can shut my eyes and still feel that shame and embarrassment washing over me. When the guard finally did find us, we were taken to a shelter. A kind white lady gave me a cup of hot milk. I can still hear her say, "Here, baby, drink this." And I said, "No, thanks, I don't drink milk." So the sweet lady went and got me an apple. I still hate hot milk. But looking back, right in the middle of that massacre, I guess I shouldn't have been so particular, but I'm still ashamed. Imagine being an 11-year-old girl forced to flee in your nakedness from your home at night. This is the story of Oscar Washington, who was born in February 1912 and who moved to St. Louis, Missouri. I was 9 years old when the massacre began, and my sister was seven. We were out playing in the yard on June 1st, and we looked up in the sky and saw airplanes flying low. Later that evening, things had gotten so bad that black people were running everywhere trying to get out of the commotion. Now, he lived outside of Greenwood area in another portion of Tulsa. There were shootings and burnings and lootings and airplanes dropping fire from the sky, setting everything on fire in the Greenwood district and surrounding areas. Pure chaos and terror. The black deputy policeman, Barney Cleaver, rode his horse through the community, warning people to get out quickly, to flee to the north. So we joined the running, scared-to-death crowds. We just took the first handful of belongings we could grab and ran down the Santa Fe Railroad track. I remember that the item my father picked up was his gun. Instead of running north with the rest of the crowd, we went east to Veneta, Oklahoma, where we had relatives. We walked every step of the way to Veneta. It's about 60 miles. It was a long walk, especially for the babies. When some kind of peace was restored in Tulsa, we returned home and found out that we were one of the lucky families because our house had not burned. Most black Tulsa refugees fled to nearby settlements and towns such as Sand Springs, Sepulpa, Alsuma, and Turley, but others fled much, some of them walking the entire distance. Some went north to places such as Nevada. Still other places people went to places like Veneta, 50 or more miles away. Others caught the first thing smoking and fled to other cities, St. Louis, Oklahoma City, even south to Dallas, and some went west to California, vowing never again to be subjected to such violence. Little did we know that in 2021, we would still be fighting the same fight and struggling the same struggle. Alan Matthew White, who was born in 1917, said it on the morning of the worst day of the Tulsa riot, June 1st, 1921. His parents joined the crowd of black people trying to get out of Greenwood to safety. They ran first to the elementary school, but when mobs overran the school, they jumped into one of the few jitney buses that was still running. He was 4 years old, and he remembers, he says, being scared and crying. His mother and his older sister talked often about it. Airplanes were flying over the area, dropping fire on what was left of the rubble. Mostly women and children were being picked up by the jitney bus. Looking out their windows at their men folks and others who were trying to outrun the mobsters, babies screaming, mothers crying. A white man on the bus, this is the guy who got on the bus that the white man was running and who told them to duck down below the windows and carried them to the city outskirts where they followed the railroad tracks to what they thought would be safety. That story was told over and over and over of people who fled carrying nothing or the few things that they could grab, wrapped up in a tablecloth or a blanket if they were lucky, wearing whatever they were wearing when the mob came to their door if they were unlucky. The militia found some of the people huddled in the park, and they fed them bologna sandwiches and milk. But the food was scarce, the water was scarce. And as I said, the city of Tulsa cut off both electricity and water to the Greenwood District. So even people who were in structures that did not get bombed or burned to the ground were still held in filth and squalor. It was never safe. It wasn't safe then, and it is not safe now. Does anybody know the answer to the question what the second American city to be bombed from the air was? And I'm not counting Honolulu and Pearl Harbor, because on December 7th, 1941, Honolulu was a territory and had not been admitted to the Union. So there were two cities that were part of the United States of America that were bombed to the air. Does anybody know what that second city was? Well, I'm going to tell you. It was Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1985, when a helicopter run by the city, that had a black mayor at the time, by the way, dropped C4 explosives on the house occupied by the people of MOVE and burnt down basically an entire square city block in Philadelphia. Black people standing up for our rights and living our best lives have been the targets of the only two times that bombs have fallen on a city that is part of the United States of America. About 2 years, scant 2 years prior to the Tulsa massacre, the city of Elaine, Arkansas, just across the Arkansas River, not more than 100 miles from Tulsa, had been burned and looted by a mob, and it is estimated that over 800 African people perished in that conflagration. This story has been told over and over and over again in the United States of America and in other parts of the world. January 1923, the Rosewood Massacre, the white supremacist destruction of the black town of Rosewood that killed hundreds of people. Rosewood was in Florida, by the way. Over and over, this has occurred. I'm not pronouncing this right. The Okeek, or more than 15 African people killed in Ocoee, Florida, on November 2nd, 1920. Bogalusa, Louisiana, a labor attack on an interracial labor solidarity rally that killed dozens of people in Bogalusa, and then the violence spread to the surrounding areas and African people. In the Elaine massacre, which, by the way, occurred September 30th of 1919, after about 800 people were killed, 67 of the survivors were indicted for inciting violence. I guess you're inciting violence if you're black and standing there and trying to survive. And let's not forget, this is not a Southern issue, because on July 27, 1919, it was called the Red Summer in Chicago. A white police officer refused to make an arrest in the murder of a black teenager, and violence broke out, and at least 38 people were killed, and thousands of black homes were looted and damaged. I remember the neighborhood that rebuilt after that. I was born and raised in Chicago. In 1919, white mobs attacked Africans in uniform returning from the war in Washington, D.C. They were returning from World War I, and they attacked and killed an untold number of black men who had returned from the war fighting for this country, because they said that African men did not have the right to wear that uniform. The story goes on and on and on. We don't know their names. We can't say their names, but we can remember their stories. We can remember their struggle, and we can vow to organize, to mobilize, to stand up, to defend ourselves, to press for policies and procedures that are genocidal, and to gain our freedom from oppression.
You know, Sister Camille, I'll just make some observations by just looking at this issue of our history. You know, Brother Malcolm, you know, paraphrasing him when he talked about the importance of history. He said, history is best to reward those who research. Given the history that you have just articulated to us, the question becomes, what lessons should we have learned and should we learn from this particular phenomenon as we talk about this whole question of toss of 1921, then and now? Because in your storytelling, one of the things came to mind is that there seemed to be historical narrative and policy and principle as we talk about Western history and the history of the U.S., the making of the U.S., is that they have a dialectical opposed to any African right to be self, right towards self-determination. We have no right to be a free people based upon that history and that behavior. Also, when we look at this history of what took place in 1921, that seemed to be, and you are correct, in terms of we must not look at this from a local regional perspective. It's a global one. I think one of the things that we said earlier at the beginning of the program, when we talk about the concept of freedom, that one of the concept of freedom that we need to take a push to is the idea that the only way we get our freedom for ourselves is to identify ourselves with every oppressed people in the world. We are blood brothers to the people of Brazil, Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba, yes, Cuba, too. Now, this narrative, as you stated, has been done to our people globally all around the world. The question becomes, at what point in time do we internalize the essence of our history and take it for what it is, you know, understand these lessons and apply them to our intelligent way of thinking as human beings?
Well, I tell you, brother, one of the lessons that we definitely must take away from this and other incidents like this is that the system that oppresses you cannot and will not ever make you free. When I hear my sisters and brothers talking about green power and black entrepreneurship as the way that we're going to pull ourselves out of our oppression, I don't laugh because it's tragic. It isn't funny. The problem is when you are powerless politically and ultimately economically, which is the same thing, by the way, it doesn't matter how much individual wealth you amass. Oprah Winfrey, arguably the richest African woman in the world, is still a nigger as far as many white people are concerned. Barack Obama, who became president of this country, is still a nigger, okay? And so are you, and all the money you amass is not going to change that relationship to power. And so when I hear my sisters and brothers talking about, I want my piece of the pie, I think you need to take that pie and pitch it into the garbage can and bake you a new cake that's altogether different. And your new cake has to be based upon principles of solidarity, principles of communalism, principles of socialism, principles of self-determination that are not patterned after the capitalist system that oppressed you, that called you property, that bought and sold you and literally worked you to death in the fields of America, in the fields of Central America, in the fields of the Caribbean, in the fields of Brazil and Colombia and Venezuela and elsewhere throughout this hemisphere, in the land of our origin, the continent of Africa. If you try to follow that system and use it to gain your freedom and from oppression, you are barking up the wrong tree, honey. You got to throw away the pie. There is no piece of that pie. It's poison. There is no piece of that pie of a capitalist economy that is going to grant you freedom from oppression. International solidarity, local solidarity, and the kind of self-determination that brings us all along into a sustainable and just existence is the only answer.
Sister Camille, what we're going to do right now, we're going to take this one caller, and then we're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're just going to have you give us your final thoughts on this phenomenon and we'll be make a few announcements, and we'll be closing out this program. So right now we have this caller being on very patiently. We can go to caller. Your last four numbers are 4298. Caller 4298. Your question or comments, caller 4298.
Thank you, thank you. And greetings to Sister Camille. It's great to hear your voice and hear your analysis. Certainly the MOVE organization was bombed by the Rezo and the Philadelphia Pigs, and we stand in solidarity with them, and we still feel like reparations are in order for them and us as a people in general. I thank you for your analysis. Thank you for your dedication to the struggle, and I just wanted to give greetings. Thank you.
Thank you, my brother.
Okay, you're listening to MPH Radio. Our theme today is Tulsa, 1921, then and now. The question for today is, what has changed since then and now? What we're going to do, we're going to a station break with music with a message. And when we come back, we will have our final thoughts with Sister Camille and the rest of the participants on today's program. This is MPH Radio. Try to get rid of some of this confusion by filling in our missing pages of history. Today we've been speaking with Sister Camille out of Oklahoma. She's giving us a historical perspective on Tulsa 1921, then and now. In closing, we'd like to ask our Sister Camille just give her final thoughts on this particular phenomenon and how can we invite her and how can we support her bookstore as of right now. So Camille, tell us a little something about your final thoughts and how can we support you, how can we invite you maybe to come to some of our schools, universities, and communities to speak in and continue to fill in some of our missing pages of history.
Thank you. Let me say that what the people of Greenwood and Black voices throughout the world are demanding now is restorative justice. I like that word better than the word reparations, because people tend to boil reparations down to a dollar figure, and dollars don't mean nothing. You remember Brother Rapp told the story of how the white man went in and said, could go in and say, okay, for every rock you bring me, I'm going to give you a dollar. And as soon as he got all the rocks, he go say, and you got all the dollars, he go say, now we're using rocks for money. Without power, money is meaningless, because money is symbolic. It is not real. So demanding a cash payment does not begin to make things straight. What we need to demand is restorative justice, restoring us to the status that we had before we were subjected to oppression, restoring Tulsa's Greenwood community to the status it had prior to the massacre that took place in 1921, restoring Africa to its independent, self-determinate place that it was prior to colonialism, and on and on and on. We stand up and we raise our fists to the air and we cry, no justice, no peace. And we walk in the steps of our prophets, like Brother Malcolm, who said, you can't separate peace from freedom, because no one can be at peace unless that person has their freedom. So when we talk about restorative justice, we are also talking about control, ownership and control of our own communities, of our own destiny. Again, I'm not talking about Black capitalism. I'm talking about Black communalism. I'm talking about socialist Pan-Africanism. I'm talking about true liberation, and that is what we must work toward if there is any hope of survival, much less for our communities to thrive. I want to thank you all for listening to me today, and I want to ask you to never forget what went on in Tulsa and the other problems, the other depredations and oppression that our ancestors and each and every one of us have experienced. I want to also say to ask you to support your Black-owned bookstores. Learn your history. Know your history. Teach your history, because it is only out of that crucible that our knowledge and our wisdom will grow and be able to be put to use in our struggle for liberation. Nappy Roots Bookstore is located in Oklahoma City, and if you're of mind to acquire any of those books, then they are available from us. But if you've got a Black bookstore in your own town, for God's sake, support them. Nappy Roots Books can be found at nappyrootsbooks.com on the Internet, or by email, nappyrootsbooks@gmail.com if you want to order a book. But find your history, know your history, absorb your history, and teach your history to others so that we can move forward as a people toward our own liberation and ultimately the only kind of peace that's real peace, which is the peace that is founded in justice.
And on a note, Sister Camille, we thank you for sharing your perspective on Tulsa 1921, then and now. We thank you very much. And to our listening audience, we're going to make our final thoughts right now. We can go to caller 4298, see if the caller has any final thoughts. Brother, caller 4298, your final thoughts on today's program. 4298.
Thank you, Anna. It's been a very, very educational program, and I thank the sister for being so diligent in terms of studying our history and presenting it so eloquently. And I just look forward to another educational session. Thank you.
And we thank you for your support, caller. Next, we'll go to Susie, and we'll ask Susie to give her thoughts, her final thoughts on this program. Susie, your final thoughts for today's program.
I'd like to thank Ms. Camille. It's really been a missing pages of history because of the fact that a lot of people weren't familiar with 1921. And so now we have it out there and we can continue to learn our community. One of the many tragedies that we as a people have gone through. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for your contribution to today's program. Next, we'll go to our co-host, Brother Alex Arizona. Give us your thoughts and your comments for today's program. Brother Alex.
Yes, again, so much information on a wonderful, wonderful day, and I'm just overjoyed. But I would also like to remind our listeners that a moment in history happened when the first president ever went out to Tulsa. Whether it was in his heart or not, because we know the old Joe Biden. We know the Joe Biden that made promises during his campaign. And we know the Joe Biden that is now trying to do whatever he can. So whether it's sincere or not, he was the first president to go out there and acknowledge. And just like she said, the white girl that stood up in the class and walked out and said it didn't exist, it didn't happen. In so many white minds, whether they know it happened or not, they're trying to shut our history out. They're trying to shut our meaning out. They want to keep us humble and disgraced so that we cannot achieve the wealth, the education, the understanding that they have. But believe me, it is in your heart. It is in your will. It is in your power to go ahead and be the success that you can be. There will be obstacles. There will be roadblocks. If you have to move out of America, as so many people have, if you have to go anywhere in the world to be the person that you want to be, as I said before, do not let anybody, anything, anyone stop your right to freedom. But voice your opinion. If you want to remain, to stay where you were born, your forefathers were born, make the white live up to that creed that all men are created equal. That is a country made for the just and right. Because it has not honored that creed. And it has looked down upon blacks since our inception here in South America. So as we go forward, let's look forward to make our lives better, regardless of the obstacle, and rise up. Just as our ancestors did in those chains and shackles. Rise up. Show that we are people that deserve the honor, that we are a nation in a nation, and we will continue to fight for our rights. And I thank you.
Thank you, Alex. You know, listen to the history of Tulsa, 1921, then and now. And the presentation from Sister Camille, it is true where they say that when it comes to African history has a very powerful past. And we need to understand our past, know our past, so we can understand the present. And we use that as a basis to build a brighter future. One of the lessons come to my mind that we need to be constantly reminded of, as we talk about freedom and power, this one is quote by Frederick Douglass. And he stated, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concede nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. From Frederick Douglass, The Voice MPH Radio, we say to you, the only ones who can free you is you. Let's come together. Let our history continue to fill in our missing pages. Once we have done that, we have a blueprint to move forward and make a new world where we, as oppressed people, we become free people, as well as when we look at the oppression that faces humanity in general, we will eradicate all forms of oppression. We thank you for allowing us to come in your homes this evening. where we spoke truth to the powerless and the powerful. This is a program that comes on every other weekly, bi-weekly, on Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's under the banner of Missing Page of History, Inc., and we would like to let you know that we are open for memberships, supporters, and to join our fan club. If you have an interest, please just email us at mphradio@yahoo.com, mphradio@yahoo.com. And we can tell you how you can support our organization, this radio program, and become an active member. So until next time, we hope to see everyone. Please share the word. And remember, when we think about Tulsa, 1921, then and now, we are, in essence, we are saying that the struggles continue. This has been Missing Pages of History, and we leave you with some music of inspiration and messages.
Choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one?
When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me, but I was acquitted a month and 3 days before Tupac was born. I was real happy because I had a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the street. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Said tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than us, a little kid. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blamed mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hugging on my mama from a jail cell. Thinking elementary. Hey, I see the penitentiary. One day, running from the police. That's right. Mama catch me, put a whooping to my backside. And even as a queen mama, you always was a black queen mama. I finally understand, for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it, there's no way I can pay you back, but the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear mama,
please, no one above you.
You all appreciate it. Nobody tell us it was fair. No love for my daddy, cause the coward wasn't there. He passed away and I didn't cry, cause my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong and I'm heartless, but all along I was looking for a father, he was gone. I hung around with the thugs, and even though they showed a young brother love, I moved out and started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I sang it. I ain't guilty, cause even though I said it feels good putting money in your mailbox, I love paying rent when the rent's due. I hope you got the diamond necklace that I sent to you, cause when I was low, you was there for me. You never left me alone because you cared for me. And I can see you coming home after work late. You're in the kitchen trying to fix us a hot plate. Just working with the scraps she was given, and mama made miracles every Thanksgiving. But now the road got rough, you're alone, trying to raise two bad kids on your own. And there's no way I can pay you back, but my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. And dear mama, you all appreciate it. Some liquor and I reminisce, cause through the drama I can always depend on my mama. And when it seems that I'm hopeless, you say the words that can get me back in focus. When I was sick as a little kid, to keep me happy there's no limit to the things you did. And all my childhood memories are full of all the sweet things you did for me. And even though I act crazy, I gotta thank the Lord that you made me. There are no words that can express how I feel. You never kept a secret, always stayed real. And I appreciate how you raised me, and all the extra love that you gave me. I wish I could take the pain away. If you can make it through the night, there's a brighter day. Everything will be alright if you hold on. It's a struggle every day, gotta roll on. And there's no way I can pay you back, but my plan is to show you that I understand. You are.
sitting in the morning sun. I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in. Then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. What 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. It's 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time.
Bye. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you will look for yours unheard. And now when you see the light, you stand up for your eyes. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Yep, yeah.
Stand up for your rights.
Yes.